Are you passionate about our region and its future? Do you want Geelong to be more livable, innovative and resilient? Then connect with Geelong Sustainability, a community group working to create a smarter, fairer, healthier future for Geelong.
The Sustainable Hour.
Geelong Sustainability.
Sponsoring The Pulse.
Good morning, listeners. As always, we'd like to start the program by acknowledging that we're on the land of the Wathaurong people, and we pay tribute to the elders past, present, and those that are to come, and we acknowledge the work that they did in being custodians of this land for millennia. And finally, we acknowledge the work that One Fire is doing in Geelong for reconciliation, and long may it continue.
Good morning, listeners, and good morning here in the studio. Rusty, welcome.
Good morning.
Tony, how are you?
Good. All fired up, Mick. And Bill Shorten did it to me.
Should we jump right into saying welcome to our guest of the day, Ernesto Sanchez. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much, guys, for having me on your show today. It's a real privilege to be joining this crew.
Well, we've invited you because I see you as a bit of a novelty when it comes to water. And we'll be talking more about why, but we should mention to listeners who are not aware that today is the World Water Day. So we have all these UN days for this and for that. We had the UN Day for Happiness, and yesterday was the big International Day for the Forest.
And also World Poets Day.
Ah, okay. Yeah, there are many of these days, but today is about water, certainly here in the Sustainable Hour. We've prepared a little bit. We'll be talking later about water energy, hydro projects and stuff like that. But I'll tell you why, Ernesto, that I see you as a water person. We visited your house. It was Sustainable House Day, and you opened the doors, and people came in. Lots of people came in. How many people came in on that day?
Well,
must have been hundreds.
There was. We had over 100 people coming to my property on that day. And I think a lot of people still managed to miss out on that day. But yeah, we had a really, really good turnout, and we were able to show and share a lot of information of what we're doing sustainability-wise at my place.
Exactly. And I knew you on beforehand because you are one of the few people in this town who have actually started a business selling worms. You have a worm farm. So I knew you as the worm guy, you know. But when I came to your house, the first thing you said was, this is about water. And you took us out to that place where the water comes down from the roof. And maybe you should just take our listeners on a little bit on a tour, how you explain when people come to your house. And you know they're interested in worms, but you start somewhere else. You start with the water. Why?
Yeah, well, it's all based on a permaculture design. And life and everything in general depends on water. So for me to be able to be really, really sustainable on what we're doing, we had to plant the water first in our design. So everything starts by looking at what you have and what the energies that are coming to your property are and how you can use those energies and harvest them, or as you can divert those energies because they can be either positive or they can be damaging to your property. We're trying to grow as much food as we can at home, but like I said, everything that's living depends on water. So we started designing a system that allows us to be almost 100% fully sustainable, self-sustainable in water, and we design a closed loop. So we get water from rain, we store it in tank, but we also store it in our soil, which is probably the biggest water tank that we have. Then that gets used into the house, and it gets treated as gray water through a reed bed, basically mimicking the processes that happen in nature, and then it comes diverted into the gardens, and then the food that is produced into the garden comes back into the house, and then it goes out again into the compost or either through the worms or through the chickens. So we manage to keep that cycle of water
and it comes back to the house again, because then the chicken lay eggs.
Yeah, exactly. So it comes out as food again into the house. It goes outside the house, either into the compost or into the chickens for feed or to the worms, and that allows us to continue growing more food. So the energy and all the organic matter that is being produced in the water, of course, as well, gets kept into my site.
Fantastic. So it all begins with the water.
Everything starts with water.
And you've actually had a plumber out and designed all the... It's fascinating to see because it isn't that simple. You know, you've got to have all these tubes running here and there, and the big tank here and a smaller tank there, and so on.
It is all actually very simple, Mick, but you do have to take the time to design things well. I think when you're thinking about sustainability and trying to achieve a system that works together as a whole, the main thing is to spend the time designing and thinking about what you're going to do. Once you're 100% satisfied with what you have, make sure that you have closed the loop, that you followed your ethicals, your ethics, that you have followed your design principles, then you start to implement. And the whole system was designed by myself, but I'm not a qualified plumber, of course, so I needed somebody to put all this together for me, and that was my neighbor. So he just lives across the street. He's a qualified plumber, and I was able to work together with him because he wasn't probably – it's a bit unusual. Like, he's told me that nobody – he had ever done something similar to what I've done at my place. He'd never worked with somebody like that. So it was new for him as well. So we were both learning together as we went, and we managed to put everything together. And I was really happy because if anything goes wrong, he's just across the road and he can fix it. But absolutely nothing has gone wrong. We got all the approvals from the council, and everything is just working perfect, and we are absolutely loving it at the moment with that.
That's such a good story. I mean, that is one of those stories that I'm proud to send out to the rest of Australia, because you are a first mover, and you've done it, and it works. How good is that? And I meet so many people. Every day I sit and talk with somebody who wants to do what you're doing in a way. I think there's a big movement at the moment where people are beginning to see that what we can do at home is actually quite powerful, and it's fun too.
I think that that's a very important point, but I think that the main reason why we're starting to get all this interest in the community at the moment, not only at community level, but at town level, nation, and even worldwide, is because we're starting to see that we are having some major environmental issues that we really need to tackle, and that we really need to take initiative into solving these problems. And water is definitely one of the things that we need to start to look at, because if we don't start understanding how water works and how we can work with water and not against it, we are going to suffer a lot. We're already suffering a lot. Like, if you look at what's happening in the world in terms of drought, for example, you're starting to look at Africa, for example, and you have a potential of about 20 million people going into starvation right now as we're speaking, because their countries have been in drought and many other reasons connected to that. When I came here to Australia about 10 years ago, we were just at the peak of the drought as well, and I've never experienced anything like that, and I remember all the water restrictions that we have and how dry it was. I come from the tropics, but I'm from Colombia, and we lived in the Caribbean coast, and we've got a tropical climate over there, so we had rain pretty much all the time. And when I came here at the peak of the drought, it was just shocking for me, and it was really weird. I've never lived in water restrictions before. So that also started my thinking and changed the way I look at water from that very, very beginning. And as my life experience was progressing here in Australia, I started to understand, study, prepare myself, and start to take action, because it is very important for us as individuals and as households to start taking action into the things that we think are wrong, and that we can start fixing ourselves, because nobody's going to come and do it for us. I see that we're always blaming governments for what's going wrong, and that they don't do this, that they don't do that, but they're never going to solve many of the problems that we have for us. It's us who have to take action, and we are the ones who have to find solutions to the problems that we're facing. And generating awareness, opening our homes, getting together with community, getting together with your neighbors, and trying to work solutions at the local level is what's really going to start bringing upon change and making our lives better and get us prepared and to be more resilient with the changes that we cannot deny, that we have changes in climate and that things are really not looking very good. So we need to start building up resilience at community levels, at family levels, home levels, you as yourself, to be able to withstand what's going to be coming, what's happening actually right now as we speak.
That's right.
We've had a theme going through a number of programs over the last couple of months since we came back from holidays, and that's been water. Now, I have been heavily involved in this area in horticulture. But what you've done is brought it in at a local level, which is fantastic. But one of the greatest challenges I see as we've gone into, we go into the climate emergency, is the security of water. We can get overcome so many other things, but water is the crucial thing. And we need to bring it back to our own house. You know, I was brought up in a large property, and we had bore water from the ground, and we had to have rainwater tanks. So it's second nature to me, but it isn't. The education hasn't gone through to the other people. And what you've managed to do is start very small. Things like Sustainable House Day is a great education resource. What we now need to do is take it a little bit further and keep the education process going.
You touched on a point there that I think it's relevant to talk a little bit more about, which is that one of bringing things into the urban space. The principles that you apply in design and in permaculture design in general are exactly the same, no matter if you are bringing them into a small, intensive urban garden or if you're taking that to a, you know, massive acreage agricultural property. The principles and the concepts are exactly the same. You just need to scale them back. And that is something that is very, very important to understand. What we're doing at my small garden, it's about 60 square meters of gardening space, follow exactly the same principles that you would need to follow if you were farming on a larger agricultural scale. So I think that's something very important to understand, because water behaves exactly the same way in large amounts of land or just coming down and trickling down from a roof into a tank. It's exactly the same things that you gotta understand about water to be able to be successful managing the water.
The other thing I see is that your plot is very small, and the, overall, it's not just that the garden's small, the whole block is small. And what I made comment to the people with me the other day was that why can't this be done in some of these unit developments that are even being done around town? That would then change the nature of those completely, because what we're seeing is a very high proportion of the area put across to what is a hard surface, and there is some formula which I've just forgotten they're allowed to get away with. But by putting your principles in, we can be using this for developments where we have infill in some of the inner cities. It's all there.
That's starting to happen too. I think it's really interesting to hear you say in this, though, that the value of the soil being a reservoir for the water. Do you want to tease that out a little bit?
Yeah, well, it's quite simple. I'm just going to put it as simple as I can for it. You got to look at soil not as something that's dead. Soil is something that's alive. Like, the amount of life that you find in a teaspoon of soil is incredible compared to what you find above the surface of the soil. That's scientifically proven. And once you understand that, you know that every living thing that's in the water, in the soil, is actually, it's made out of water. Whether it's a small bacteria, protozoa, a worm, it's like a little mini tank of water, okay, but it's just held in a living form. So if you have a living soil, that means that all the living elements of that soil are actually storing water for you. And by having that life present in your soil, they're also building up that soil, building up the structure, and building more soil as they go. So from a permaculture perspective, soil is always going to be your main storage of water. And if you even linked onto that, all the things that are living from that soil, and I'm talking in the form and way of plants now, they're also water storages that stem out of your soil. So if you put the trees on top of that soil now, that's also water storages that you're adding onto that. Then all the wildlife that comes as a consequence of having all this living environment set up, it's just more water storages that you're having all there. So it's understanding everything as a system and just trying to make the best that you can to keep that, to keep feeding and to keep that system going. That's all you have to do.
Yeah, we've had Peter Andrews talking about, well, he wasn't talking on the program, it was one of his proteges, but he's developed on a large scale this water recharge areas. And what you've done to a large extent is copied that on a much smaller scale, as you've just outlined to us. And that system is usable within, certainly, suburbia.
Yeah, Peter is a great example to follow. It seems that a number of people I've spoken to, his approach puts people off. Like I think he's just so frustrated from not being listened to that he's turned people off. But if we could somehow get past that and look at what he's actually done, what he's achieved over the years, like decades now, that it would be, yeah, we're losing his message, and there's going to be some time in the not all that distant future that information will be lost if we don't do something about it.
So, well, reasonably fortunate that Australian Story have covered him a couple of times, so we've still got that legacy.
Ernesto, tell me this permaculture thing. Our listeners may not know what permaculture is, and maybe you could explain it in this way. How did you hear about it the first time, and how did you get into it, and what happened? What is permaculture?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And permaculture is, first of all, it was something that was, it's a sustainable system of design based on ethics and principles. So it's as simple as that. And the beauty of this is that it was invented and created here in Australia. It was developed at the end of the 70s by Bill Mollison and David Holmgren. And it's just based on the observation of nature. So how did I get to that? I was working as a chef, and I was working with food. And while I was working with food, I started to wonder about it. Like, you know, why are the tomatoes getting so expensive in this time of the year? Why are they tasting like that? You know, all these variations in food. And I just started to have an interest in how our food was being produced. And I just started to do some research, started to read some books, go on the internet, and then stumbled across permaculture. And when I was just reading about it, I just blew my mind straight away. I knew that hit the nail in the head. And some people tend to just relate it to gardening, but it's not about gardening. It's a whole holistic, sustainable, ethical. And I just want to mention that again. Ethics are the pillars of permaculture. If you follow the three, everything that you do that stems out from an ethical perspective is going to produce only good to a society and to the world in general. And that's what I think permaculture is so successful in everything that we do. So you're connecting all the human ethical aspect, and then you're linking that with the observation and understanding of the principles that happen and the patterns that happen in nature. So once you combine those two things together, you cannot go wrong.
So what's an example? I'm interested in the continual use of the word ethics and in describing what permaculture is. What's an example of an ethical decision that you'd be faced with when you're starting from scratch?
Well, permaculture basically works on three ethics. One is the care of people. So everything that you do have to be orientated into caring for people, which is what nature does. If we start looking at and working with nature, nature cares for everyone. Nature provides not only for people, but it also provides for anything that's alive in the world, okay, based on water again. So nature is what is, water is what is allowing life to be here on the planet in every single form, from bacterial form to more complicated species like we are. And then you follow to care for the planet. Okay, so that's your second ethics. And then you go into the fair share, which is basically trying to put every excess of production that you have. Nature is abundant, and nature is always going to produce more than what is required. If you let it run wild, it would always produce and produce and produce. Okay, so we as designers, we have to find a way in which we put all this excess surplus that we have back into the system. And I'm not only talking about excess physical things that we can use or give away or put back into the compost, etc. We also talk about putting knowledge. If you're gaining experiences, if you're gaining knowledge, that's part of your fair share. Putting that back into your community, putting that back into your cities, putting that back into your workplace, opening your house on sustainable day for people to come and have a look. So that's pretty much sums up what the ethical aspects of permaculture are.
So it's a system and working with it rather than against it, nature being the system.
Mm.
Is that correct?
That fascinates me in the sense that I try to teach my children, you know, that if you want a happy life, you have to understand that giving actually makes you happier than taking. And that's sort of, you're saying that's a basic ethic in permaculture. I didn't know that.
Yeah, well, you know, we're taking all the time. As living beings, we're taking energies in different forms all the time. So we have to understand that these things are given to us so we can continue to live and prosper as an individual and as part of a community and a society. So we also have to find ways to give back, because only when you give back and you spread the resources that are around for everyone else, everybody is going to be better off.
Yeah, and more satisfied in many ways. What my point is that there's a lot of unhappy people out there and a lot of frustration, and you see people, you know, all the problems with depressed people, suicides,
drugs
in particular, maybe drugs, and where people are just, you know, they've lost meaning in many ways. And the funny thing is, when you begin, like you're saying, to give and to spread joy to others, it becomes very, very meaningful. I think that is a very deep thing that human beings have known for centuries and centuries, that it's a great thing. It comes back to you. The universe gives back to you what you give out, and so on. And it's just very satisfying.
I remind you, Mick, of the interview with Matt a week or two ago, where he talked about ancestry and going back and looking at how things were done and going back to those older plants and looking at the ways they did it.
Yep.
And I think you can tell by the interview how happy Matt and Lentil are.
Yeah.
So there's a prime example.
Another example.
And we've got another one in the studio.
But hang on there. That's interesting, because we started talking about water pipes and how you organized your garden and stuff. And now we're basically talking about, you know,
civilization.
And we're talking about the deeper things behind it all. That's
very
interesting.
So the whole point is, it is all linked. You've got to go back to this basic way of life. Yeah. You know my background, but most of the listeners won't. I opted out of the corporate world because it's just too frightening, too stressful. I won't tell you what the doctor said to me, but, you know, I had to do something. And I've gone back to this quieter life. The boys are laughing. But I am a lot quieter than I used to be. And it's just so much happier.
Definitely.
Water has another function that we could harness water in a different way as well, which is as an energy source. It could actually produce a lot more electricity to us, the Australians, from waves in the sea, but also from the little creeks where the water is running. And the funny thing is, people have done that back in time. They've actually gotten energy out of the water that way for centuries and centuries.
It would have been first energy source.
Yeah,
imagine.
Probably, just exactly. Just put a wheel into the water, and it goes round and round, and you can use that energy. And the interesting thing is that that's sort of being revived now. A little bit north of Geelong, we have Daylesford, and you talked earlier today with Taryn.
Yeah, Taryn Lane from Hepburn Wind, and they're now going into Hepburn Water. So
play
a bit of that now.
In the beginning, she's just talking a little bit about where she's coming from, in a way, and her own background.
I'm the community manager for Hepburn Wind. So I've been with the wind farm for about 7 years now, and we've been generating for just over 5. So I live out in central Victoria, and yeah, I'm very passionate about appropriate community development. So my background's in community development, and it just so happens that it's been applied to renewable energy for the past 7 years. But before that, I worked with Indigenous communities in East Timor, Mexico and Guatemala for 6 years before that. So the crossover for that is, you know, how do we work with communities for them to design the best outcomes and sustainable futures for themselves. So that's what I'm very passionate about. For us, with our organisation, I think, you know, we have so much support in our local community, and we are a community organisation. So it was, you know, it was an easier walk for us to be able to go, look, we're a community organisation. If you have concerns, you can just come in. The door's always open, and we'll sit down and have a face-to-face chat. So for us, you know, we sort of had that approach. But for the sector more broadly, for the wind sector more broadly, it was really important to work with advocacy groups and help to get good and positive stories about wind out there. So, you know, Friends of the Earth are really fundamental in that. Also, we established the Australian Wind Alliance, which I'm still on the board of now, and that was about, you know, really trying to also make farmers and people working in the wind industry and people who support wind energy more broadly feel connected to something and not sort of constantly attacked. So definitely that solidarity, that feeling of solidarity was really important.
Yeah, terrific and well done. I think you've shown a lot of other groups the way. Am I correct in saying that you were the first, Hepburn Wind was the first community energy project in the country?
Yeah, that's right. We were, definitely. So, but very much, you know, based on a model that's very mainstream in countries like Denmark, Germany and Scotland. So,
yep.
So nothing new about the model, but definitely new in the Australian space.
Yeah. And now there are in excess of 60 projects that are either running or in various stages of getting up.
Yeah. So there's 55 projects that have been built in Australia, and there's around 83 groups around Australia, and 26 of those groups are in Victoria.
Wow.
Mm.
Okay, that must have been really a great pleasure to see that all happening.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, what we really intended was to help catalyse the movement. So that's why we spent, you know, so much time building awareness and running campaigns and educating people and bringing them along, whether or not they were investors. We really put a lot of time into helping the movement start. So, yes, it's wonderful to see how it's really taking off now.
Now, so we've been starting out with wind. Now, why the move to water?
Sure. So, I mean, we're moving to a range of things. We're looking at a bunch of solar projects as well. But the water project is very, very sweet because we, historically, Victoria was powered in a very decentralised way, and a lot of the localised electricity networks were owned by community companies. So actually, you know, we haven't done something new. We're simply leading the way of moving back to how we used to operate in regards to that sort of cooperative and decentralised model. So in our local area at Lake Dalesford, there used to be there still is, but it used to be operating an antique microhydro station of about 13 kilowatts that operated at the lake from between 1890 and 1934 when it was decommissioned. But it's still all there in this old shed, and with this, you know, old vintage sort of set of structures to support it. And so we've been working to basically clean it up and, you know, fix up the shed, so get our local men's shed involved in fixing up the shed and put a new turbine next to it. So we've been in discussions with Tamar Hydro about placing a new turbine side by side so that we can showcase the old and new and, you know, put a bit of an interactive storyboard next to it to sort of show people, you know, how it used to work and sort of celebrate it for what it is.
Making it into an educational facility as well, that's brilliant. I'm sure that's going to attract tourists.
Exactly, and especially down at Lake Dalesford, it's part of the lake that doesn't get too much love. It's sort of the part that people just walk past, so it'll be nice to have something that's there. And, you know, it's just a wonderful story. It's very small scale in regards to kilowatts, but the story I think is very important.
Yeah. Is there any final message you'd like to give to our listeners?
Oh, just on, you know, because it is International Water Day, I think, you know, it's important to not just think about access for healthy and good water, but also how water can serve you know, other key things that we need. So clean energy, you know, how it can facilitate clean energy is another really big one.
So is it actually, how long do you think it'll be before it's operating?
In the next 6 months,
yep,
is our estimation. We've got the council sending some divers down there in the next week to take a look at the pipes. But yeah, we estimate in the next.
Yeah, and that'll be community funded again. Is that the plan?
So we've already got $25,000 for it, and we estimate we need another 20. So
yep,
it'll be 100% community funded.
Yep, terrific. Hepburn Wind showing the way as always. Thanks, Taryn.
Thanks, bye.
You're right, bye.
Connect with Geelong Sustainability, a community group working to create a smarter, fairer, healthier future for Geelong.
The Sustainable Hour.
Geelong Sustainability.
Sponsoring the Pulse.
And it's the World Water Day, so we've been talking about water and permaculture, but something else, and now water and energy. This great hydro project that they're doing up there in Hepburn with the Hepburn Wind. which is now Hepburn Water almost. But something that we haven't talked with Steve Posselt about, and Steve Posselt, our listeners would know, we've talked with him in almost every show for over 1.5 months or so, which was about the climate emergency declaration. And Steve took this petition all the way to Canberra and handed over 18,000 signatures. People, Australians, who are saying that, yes, we do have a climate emergency, and they're asking Parliament to take action on that. Steve, welcome back in the show, not to talk about the declaration this time, but because you actually have a background as an engineer, which has a lot to do with water, is that right?
Hi, Mick. Yes, I do. My first big trip was between Brisbane and Adelaide when I paddled down the Darling and Murray system. I'm a civil engineer who's specialised in water for 40 years, and that trip gave me a lot of insight into how water works, and it'd be great if all our engineers could do similar trips.
What did you learn, exactly?
Well, to sum it up, I guess that our country and everywhere else that I've been is being turned into a drain, which is entirely the opposite of what we need to do. We need to turn the land into a sponge, because rivers run when it's not raining. They run when it's not raining because there's water seeps out of the ground. So what we have done is to speed up the process. Everywhere you look, you've got hard surfaces, you've got drains, you've got things that speed up the flow of water. And I learnt that when I was at a place called Clifton near Toowoomba. When an old guy said to me, I used to look up on the mountain there, and when it rained, he said, I knew that my creek down here would rise in 2.5 days, and now it's 9 hours. So if you think about that comment, and you think about the tragedy at Grantham and Toowoomba, where people died, it was a lot to do with what we've actually done to the landscape. So although my focus is on climate change, I really do like to talk about what we need to do with the land to hold the water.
Mm. It just strikes me that we talk about climate change, and that word, it annoys me sometimes, because people seem to, you know, go down in their trenches. When we hear that word, people have a fixed opinion about it already, you know, all this ideological talk, etc. But actually, what about if we talk, instead of about climate change, about water change? Because a lot of the effects of climate change has to do with water, doesn't it? You know, the flooding, the sea level rise, and many, many other aspects of what climate change brings about is about water.
Absolutely. The thing is with water that we have the same amount on the planet that we had millions of years ago. We will always have the same amount of water. It's just how it's distributed, whether it's in the oceans, whether it's in the soil, whether it's in the Sahara or in the Amazon. You know, there are major changes with distribution. And the other important thing, though, is that there's 4% more atmospheric moisture than there was before the temperature started to rise.
Wild weather.
Yeah, there's more energy there.
Mm. Yep.
So that means more intense droughts and more intense floods.
So, Steve, we don't have, you know, the full day to talk about this. So boil it down to what's your conclusion then, in a sense? You know, what should we do? You say that we've turned Australia into drains and we should have sponges, but how do we do then?
Oh, look, Peter Andrews pretty much started the debate, and he's been on Australian Story for 4 episodes over the years. There are plenty of people like Healthy Soils is a group. Lots of people understand the issue. I think it's education. I just don't know how you get through to politicians about anything, though.
Yeah, so technically, Steve, it's a matter of slowing the water down and having as little runoff as possible. Is that the essence?
Absolutely, yeah.
So what are some of the methods for doing that? Just tell our listeners.
you build a dam as a last resort. You try to hold the water in the soil, and the way Peter Andrews has done it is to put what he calls leaky dams into watercourses on his properties, and then to grow a whole pile of weeds and cut them down. When you grow more weeds, you cut them down, and you gradually build up the carbon and the soil so that we'll hold the moisture.
Yep. Hmm. Yeah, not too difficult, is it?
It's not too hard, but you've got to get the mindset around the fact that you want to retain the moisture. I mean, to prove it to yourself, have a look at how much moisture is in long grass. And then have a look at when you cut the grass, the lack of moisture in that.
Yeah. Steve, we've got a guy called Ernesto. He's in the studio this morning, and he's saying exactly the same things as you are, but on a small scale in the city. And really, it's the message that I'm getting, that it's exactly the same whether you, no matter where you are, it's the same principle involved. And maybe Ernesto, he might have a question to ask too, I'm not sure, but he's in here with us. So if you hear this Colombian voice talking to you, it's Ernesto.
Hello, Ernesto.
Hey, how you going?
Very good.
That's good, man. I'm just listening to what you were saying, and I'm definitely in agreement with the things that you're commenting on. And the one of the issues that we have is the way that we are designing our cities, for example. We are designing to drain and move water away as fast as we can, like if water was the whole enemy of the whole city. We need to start looking at, and you said about hardscapes. We're putting concrete, cement, and pavement everywhere that we can, and that just gets water to run off. We need to start looking at techniques and strategies for us to hold those waters in the cities. Here in Geelong, the water that we use comes out from the Otways. That's about 300 kilometers away. But if we started harvesting the water that annually falls in Geelong, which I think it's about 457 millimeters a year of water, and we were storing and using that water as it falls from the rain, not repelling that water away, we would pretty much be covered in the amount of water that we were using. So we need to start thinking about how we redesign the cities that we're building, how we build soft scapes to hold that water, getting water tanks, building up soils in gardens and parks. And I think that's big, big part of the solution. So we need to start thinking how we do things and trying to work with nature more and not against it, because it's all there for us to solve the problems.
Well, as you know, Ernesto, that'll cool Geelong down as well, won't it?
Exactly. So we get a beneficial domino effect for our climate and the way we live and the resources that we have. So, yeah, we need to start asking these questions, having these conversations, and taking matters as individuals in our places to see what we can do about that, and getting numbers to be able to push into our local government so we can get things happening. Because if we don't, we're going to be in serious troubles. We already are, actually. We get this rain that falls out of the blue, and it just floods everything, and we catch no water, and then straight away we're in drought again. There's no water. So, yeah, lots of questions to ask, lots of things to do, but we got to get onto it.
Exactly.
Yeah, just a couple of points there. I'm very much aware that Barwon Water and the Geelong Council are in discussions about, and I'll use incorrect terms, Steve, but it's basically a stormwater bladder underneath the roads, or Cardinia Park, and or something like Johnson Park around the place. They're very much looking at this, because we had a very heavy weather event in February 2016, and the place, there were cars just floating around the city, and that was a result of incorrect engineering. Do you agree, Steve?
Absolutely, yeah. It's incorrect engineering, but the sums are there to use. All you've got to do is look at the time of concentration when you put a rainfall event over a catchment and follow it through to velocities and power, and there's your answer, you know. Shit. You're increasing the power of the water enormously.
Steve, that's terrific once again. You're very generous with your time. And how's the recovery going on from your marathon?
I've only got two more teeth to fix. I don't know why, but but my teeth fall to bits when I do this. They crack and break.
Yeah.
So I've got three in a line. I've had one done, two to go. But one thing that that I would like to comment on is that on the trip, I didn't really get any traction in Sydney and very little in Canberra because they're cities. And so I was wondering whether cities just don't get it. Now, I know that you guys do, but I was feeling that that for some reason country people seem to understand the situation a lot better. Now, that leads me to the question as to why, with Four Corners last Monday, having probably the scariest Four Corners show we've ever seen, there has been no comment. And in Canberra and Sydney, all the comment was about 18C and how much money we're going to have to take from poor people to increase childcare.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that next week, I would say, because, you know, this film that was shown Monday night on Four Corners, The Age of Consequences, it's being replayed on the ABC numerous times. It's quite amazing. It's being played on ABC again tonight at 11 o'clock in the night, and on ABC News 24 on Saturday in the best time, you know, 8 o'clock in the evening on ABC News 24. And, of course, you can go to the ABC iView and see it. So I think the word is getting around and people are seeing this film because, like, you know, David Spratt said, you're unlikely to ever see another climate film like this one, which is a film about how the U.S. military see the challenges of global warming and how, you know, speaking of droughts, extreme weather events, sea level rise, all these things are happening. It's not something in the future. They are happening. So it's a powerful film. I agree with you. But I think the effects of that people are seeing it, we'll hear more about that in the coming weeks.
Yeah, and Sherry Goodman, the lady who played a big role in the film, is doing a tour, and she'll be in Melbourne, Sydney, Brisbane and Canberra. And I think pretty well all her shows are sold out already. So it's happening.
And Steve, the mission that you're on or were on and what we've been talking so much about was just once again emphasized yesterday when the World Meteorological Organization published its annual statement of, you know, the state of the global climate. And they said that we're seeing unprecedented heat across the globe, exceptionally low ice at both poles, and surging sea level rise. This is the World Meteorological Organization saying this. So then you can, you know, make up your mind. Do you trust them? Do you trust these scientists there? Or do you trust people like Trump?
Yes, you know, we know the answer to that.
But that we've talked a lot about this in the program. I think today we're talking about water, and you gave me the best idea of the day when we talked about that we should look more into the water aspects of climate change. And maybe, you know, take the approach of what we're dealing with climate change from the water perspective.
Yep, well, look, I don't disagree with that, but it's all multidimensional. We are going to have to cope with the temperatures that are rising, and water is a very, very significant part of that. But there's vegetation and other things that go along with it that, as a water engineer, are outside my scope.
Yep, sure, Steve. Okay, so thanks once again for your support for this show. Really appreciate it, and we'll speak to you again soon.
Thanks, guys. Love to talk to you.
Great, Steve.
Bye, Steve.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And we just should mention things that are going on locally because, you know, Earth Hour, this annual event, is coming out on Saturday. Did you know that? Earth Hour is this 1 hour at 8:30 in the evening where people gather, and then they, you know, switch off the lights, and not just, people misunderstand it when they think that they switch off their light to save energy. It's not an energy-saving project. It is about bringing people together and having some contemplations over the climate change situation and how we take action. This is what the Earth Hour is about. It's about, it's a statement. And it's actually millions of people around the world. It's businesses, all these huge landmarks in the big cities that turn out the light. And in that way, symbolize that we are together in this. Around the globe, we are together. We are one Earth. So Earth Hour, Saturday night.
And what's Geelong? I heard Geelong.
Yeah, so one interesting thing happening is that there's a film screening happening in Eastern Park. It's free, and it'll start around the time when the Earth Hour begins at 8:30. Bring some, you know, something against mosquitoes to spray, or bring a whole mosquito net or something, because there are lots of mosquitoes in Eastern Park. But the screening of the film before the flood will be happening there. And before the flood,
Leonardo.
Is this Leonardo DiCaprio's film from November, which is a great film. And if you haven't seen it, it's really time to see it now. And if you have seen it, see it again, together with the other people who will be there.
Yeah,
because that's the other element of it. It is an hour where we celebrate the fact that we are together in this.
And discussion after it?
Who knows? Who knows? I think that's just all.
I'll be surprised if that doesn't happen.
That's right.
Yeah.
So that happens in Eastern Park on the 25th of March, this Saturday, at around 8 o'clock or so.
Any other news, Mick? Anything else coming up?
Well, you know, Earth Day is coming up. And that's, don't mistake Earth Hour and Earth Day. Earth Day is also an annual event. That's on the 22nd of April always. And this year there will be a March for Science. And I think it will be, again, a global event where scientists are coming out in the streets. And I just wrote a kilometer-long blog post about that yesterday on our blog, climatesafety.info, because I really got a little bit excited when I found some different bits and pieces from history. Like, did you know that already in 1912 there was articles written about climate change and burning of coal? 1912, the scientists began talking about this. And then in 1965, the American president was warned about what this is about. There was a scientific report given over to him at a conference and everything about the consequences of us burning coal and oil and gas and so on. That was in 1965, 3 years after I was born. And 50 years has gone. And warnings have come, and that's what my blog post is about. I posted one warning after the other the scientists have been coming with. And here we are today, still now we've come to this point where politicians are even disputing the science.
Well, if I can just jump in there, Mick, I've never been as angry as I was yesterday. Bill Shorten came out and asked scientists for support so he could hammer the coalition. Coming out and talking about climate change. Now, Bill, I got a message for you that science was telling, as Mick said, and it was even before that time, that science has been saying we've got a problem. And for you to stand up yesterday and ask science for help, it shows how out of touch you are.
it's true, but it is also true that we need to help each other now. We need to get together around this. And the 22nd of April is the time to go to Melbourne and be part of that. Show who you are. Show what you think. Go out there together with the scientists on Earth Day, the 22nd of April, in Melbourne. We'll be talking more about that as we go along. There's another thing happening before that. The Stop at Danny Roadshow is coming to Melbourne on the 31st of March. But again, go to climatesafety.info and you'll find a lot of information there, including this podcast that you can share with others. If you want to hear these brilliant things that Ernesto told us today about permaculture and about the bigger perspective of why we need to be more careful with our water in our homes and starting with ourselves. The good old thing that we always end this show with, the slogan of Be the Change, which is really what you have been doing, Ernesto. Thanks for sharing this with us today.
No, it's been my absolute pleasure to join you guys in the studio today. And I just would like to say that for people that want to study or learn here a little bit more about water, I suggest that you look at the work of a guy called Brad Lancaster and his book Rainwater Harvesting for Drylands and Beyond. It's available for everyone at the Geelong Library. And there's also a documentary called Water by Saida Medvedeva and Vasily Anisimov. It's absolutely brilliant, and it talks a lot about the metaphysical aspect of water, which is something that will open a whole new perspective on water, and also the work of Johan Grander, which will blow your mind away. There's so much to talk about water. Water has a memory, how you can revitalize water and so on. It's just going to take your knowledge and understanding of water to the next level. And if you want to learn a little bit about my work, you can also go to my website. It's called geelongworms.com. There's a section there called Our Permaculture where you can learn and read about what we do at home. And it's all explained there in details. I would also be looking at running some extra garden tours for people to come and physically check out what we're doing. And my worm farms as well are all on my website, so you can come and have a look at that. So, yeah, it's been great to be here with you guys. Thank
Ernesto
you.
Sanchez, thank you so much. And I will be there on your website and
same,
checking out this.
Same.
And we'll be linking to it. You can better believe it.
And we'll add Peter Andrews.
So much from the Sustainable Hour on World Water Day. And what we end with is saying,
Be the change.
This is the news on 94.7 The Pulse.